And hello everyone, welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vincent A. Masson. Now we're both A something.
Are we getting into like a prestigious mood because we're talking about a movie that takes place in the art scene? We're getting a little precious, we're getting a little...
Yeah, I think you're giving me too much credit. I just... was being smart, but yeah, that's what we're going with.
Cool.
Art, movie, yes.
Pretension, awesome. Yeah. Cool. And credits as a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror thriller set in the art world, Velvet Buzzsaw. That will be in the second half of the show. For the first half, we are going to talk about some of the movie news items from the past week, including Batman. Ben Affleck is no longer Batman, and we'll respectfully mourn his tragedy. Right, Vince?
Yes.
And then, is Netflix colonialism? The CBC seems to think so, but do they understand what Netflix does and what colonialism means? And then finally, we're losing Ultraviolet, but we're gaining a Criterion channel. And we'll talk about that in a sec. But first... Steven Soderbergh is staying very busy despite the fact he retired like 5 years ago.
Quote unquote retired.
Quote unquote retired. He released two movies in the last couple of years. One was Logan Lucky and the other one was Unsane.
And The Nick.
Yes, he directed two seasons worth of The Nick.
Yeah.
Every episode. His new film actually comes out on Friday on Netflix. It's called High Flying Bird. But we're talking
about... We saw a high flying turd when we saw Glass last week. I had to do it.
Okay. How long have we been keeping that one in our pocket?
Yeah, far too long. Far too long. So are you trolling me? We actually get to talk about Soderbergh this episode. We have segment devoted to
it. You are the resident Soderbergh scholar, so... We're mentioning him because he's doing a round of press for High Flying Bird, and he's talking about his experiments with Logan Lucky and Unsane, which were kind of a direct marketing kind of idea that he was disappointed that studio marketing has gotten so huge, and he thought he could do it in more direct style, doing it on his own for $20 million, which is a pittance when it comes to studio marketing for something like...
But that was his whole philosophy, was that it costs way too much to market and put out these movies.
Right.
So he came along with his experiment and was like, we're going to bypass all of this, mm-hmm. And we're going to do our own thing. Mm-hmm. So now, I guess, after, you know, some time reflecting on it, he has now determined that they were both failures.
Yes.
So what... I want to be very clear about what his strategy was, though.
Yeah.
He said that the average studio movie just spends way too much on marketing, doing all of that stuff. But I did see quite a few commercials for Logan Lucky. Like, wasn't his whole philosophy to try and from what I got from the article, it's like we didn't do that much on Logan Lucky, but we did more on Unsane after seeing the results of Logan Lucky. But it's like, right. I saw quite a few commercials from what I recall for Logan Lucky. Like, they did some TV stuff for that.
Sure.
But another interesting point that he has in the article is that, like, people think legitimately, like, real movies have real trailers on TV. And it's like, that's... how a lot of people think. It's like, no, if I didn't see your movie, like a commercial for your movie on TV, then there was some off market type thing,
right? It's like, I guess an obvious correlation would be on Broadway and off Broadway, or if you're a Broadway show, you have all like ads on buses and things, and
right,
if you're off Broadway, it's, you know, maybe a flyer, maybe you know, independent media, you know, sneak previews kind of thing. So
sure, yeah. And so I guess after Logan Lucky and Unsane did their theatrical run, he has determined that no, in fact, you do need like 30 to 40 million for marketing. I think the way he said it was that nobody's going to get out of bed for marketing that's under $30 million.
Yeah. He does raise an interesting point, though, that all the studios use the same playbook for marketing, but the results are wildly different.
Mm-hmm.
You get mega hits, you get hits, you get some that break even, you get ones that almost break even, you get dumpster fires.
Yes.
So what makes the difference in terms of the marketing picture? And it's an interesting question to ask, and he took it in another direction, and I think, yeah, I remember seeing TV ads for Logan Lucky, but maybe not as many as you might see for, say, Mary Poppins Returns.
Yeah.
And maybe because we are of a certain taste, those would show up on channels we would watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was also part of his strategy, is like direct marketing to specific audiences. Like if you, I don't know, watch the Sundance Channel or watch the Movie Network or what have you, you're of maybe perhaps of more rarefied cinematic taste than somebody who's just watching, I don't know, The Big Bang Theory or NCIS or what have you.
So his strategy was also, let's market to who we're actually expecting to go see this movie. And that also failed, according to him.
Yeah.
It did occur to me. Is it possible that these movies just like weren't that good? It's like, Logan Lucky is the movie that stands out for me among the two. Mm-hmm. Logan Lucky has more production value. I think it's got a funnier script. It's got better actors.
It's got more appeal, more broad appeal.
Yeah, I really don't see the reason why that movie didn't make a significant amount of money.
Mm-hmm. It also came out in like mid-August, which is not a great time if you're...
Sure, yeah. But he keeps talking about like all of these, and this is where my friend and I, Mr. Soderbergh, have to maybe look through a different lens, is he always brings up like the strategies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, was it marketed properly? Well, did we do enough press? Did we do this, that, and the other thing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like maybe the movie just wasn't that good, man, because he keeps using Get Out as an example. It's like, well, theaters aren't dead. The theatrical like avenue isn't dead because look at Get Out. It made $300 million on like a whatever, a $7 million budget. Mm-hmm. So there you go. And it's like, yeah, but Get Out also won one Oscar for writing, and it was nominated for four. So it's like, I feel like it's kind of an anomaly. You're not going to get movies that cheap that are that good coming all the time.
It also had the fact that it was sort of timely in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, ongoing debates about racism, Black Lives Matter. And also had Jordan Peele, who's a, not that Steven Soderbergh isn't a recognizable name, but, you know, maybe people know Jordan Peele. Like, the audience to whom Get Out was going to appeal to, people who are African-American, they know Jordan Peele.
Yeah. But after a certain while, it's like it made too much money for those kinds of...
It was a cultural event.
Yeah. But, you know... Listen, like this is kind of the running gag on this show is that I bring up Steven Soderbergh all the time. I have some like unidentifiable admiration for him. And it's like I want to be clear, his filmography isn't necessarily why I respect him so much. As a matter of fact, I think his filmography is kind of hit or miss. Very much admire what he tries to do, right? He always tries to like do something. He's kind of Louis Malle, Kubrick, kind of tries to bring something different every single time.
Yeah.
But what I really admire him for are these kind of... these experiments. He's the one that's risking things a lot.
Yeah.
He's the one that's trying to find a different way of doing things. And he's quite frankly quite candid when it doesn't work, like this time. He's like, just didn't work, right? Whereas some other smooth-talking sleazeball might say, you know, it didn't – I wouldn't say it didn't work. It just didn't work to our – he was just straight up like, no, it didn't work.
Well, like Alex Proyas when Gods of Egypt came out. It's like critics just don't get it.
Yeah, and you saw that with Shyamalan too. It's like, well, they're calling me a genius over here, but only in America do they not get it. And it's like – so I admire Soderbergh, and it's – he's been doing this for a long time, right? Like he's –
It's the 30th anniversary of Sex, Lies, and Videotape appearing at Sundance.
I mean, back in the day, back in 1989, it was very unusual for a movie made for $1 million to make that kind of... So he knows kind of where... He's been around the game for like a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw with Magic Mike as well, because Magic Mike was brought up as well. They financed that 100%. So
yeah.
Both him and Channing Tatum put in $3.5 million.
Yeah.
He had a $7 million budget, and the movie just made like exorbitant amounts of money.
It's a big return on investment for them.
Yeah. But that was also, you know, that was when I saw him kind of move away from the studios. That's when he started to I think kind of balk at their
procedures. Like, what studio would have funded a, you know, $7 million movie about male strippers?
But you don't think so? I don't know, man. Because he said, he was like, this was the Halley's Comet of ideas. Channing Tatum was like, I'm working on a project about when I was a stripper,
yeah,
when I was 19 in Tampa. And Soderbergh was like, done. We're making that movie.
Yeah.
And he not only saw like the kind of the appeal in terms of story, but
right,
also he saw like the dollar amounts as well.
I know, but in a movie world where you can't fund, or where it's so hard to fund a female superhero film because studios are of the opinion, and even female studio execs are fighting this, that the studios themselves, the people with the money, are of the opinion that women don't go to the movies as much as men, when the fact of the matter is women are 52% of the movie audience.
Right, right.
So, I mean, he's not just... He had very good instincts. Him and Channing Tatum had very good instincts. And I think part of the reason the movie played so well is because it is this personal story. It is a slice of pre-fame Channing Tatum on screen there. I don't think that's the success of Magic Mike says anything about Steven Soderbergh's instincts, other than he has good instincts. I think what it said is that movies, sometimes studios don't know a good idea if it bites them in the butt.
But I think it's happening a great deal of time.
Yeah.
Like, it's happening a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like... And again, Soderbergh seems to be the only one that's like actually trying to like combat them. You know what I mean? He's actually trying to propose. He's not just going into these magazines saying, well, the studio system sucks, man.
No,
it's like he's actually coming up with different ideas, right? And, you know, like...
Well, what I appreciate is one of the things that came out of this round of interviews, he's talking about Netflix. And he refused to, or part of his deal with Netflix was, don't release it in the theaters.
Because they were like, let's do a screen in L.A., let's do one in New York. And he was like, listen, if this is an awards thing that you want in your back pocket, like,
right,
we need to figure this out.
But there's sort of an appreciation for the purity of the form.
Right.
It's like Netflix is, you watch it in your living room or your bedroom or on your laptop or your desktop or, you know, whatever you're watching it on. It's not really a... It was never really about going to the theater, although it has sort of become about that.
And he even told a story about investigating how to like start up his own streaming service, mm-hmm, realized that, one, it costs enormous amounts of money, and two,
right,
you can't just buy a backlog of movies and start a streaming service. You have to keep putting out new content, which is what Netflix, which is what the Amazons are doing.
Well, you can't...
So that's how you can compete with them.
You can't buy a back catalog now because all the studios are saving
already,
their own back,
right,
catalogs,
yeah,
for their own streaming services.
But right,
we'll get there in a sec. Speaking of superheroes, it was announced that Ben Affleck will no longer play Batman, which is something that's been rumored about since before Justice League came out. But I want to bring this up because I remember when Ben Affleck was announced to play Batman in Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice,
mm-hmm,
and the internet was incensed. They could not believe this outrage. And now that he's heading out the exit door, people are like, can you believe they're just letting Ben Affleck just leave the role? It's outrageous.
Well, that's the thing about these superhero movies. I don't think it's as big of a deal as it was, you know, way back. I remember, who was it? Andrew Garfield. Mm. He was like, oh, I was getting teary-eyed putting on the Spider-Man. It's like, it doesn't mean anything anymore, man, because in 2 weeks, somebody else is going to be putting on that suit, and they're going to be doing another reboot of the whole thing. So
right,
it's like, whatever. But
I think it depends on the part, though. I think Batman has been done so many times that we can be that, you know, sort of base about, you know, who gets to wear the cape and cowl next. But, you know, something like Wolverine, where Hugh Jackman was that character for 20 years.
That's a good point, yeah.
Or even Tony Stark, or not Tony Stark, he's not a real person. Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. Because Iron Man, you know, if you were a comic book fan,
he's Tony Stark, man.
Well,
don't you dare.
It is interesting because in the comic books in recent years, you can definitely see the influence of Robert Downey Jr. on the character. They sort of draw him to look more like Robert Downey Jr. And sound a bit more like Robert Downey Jr. But, you know, before Iron Man came out, you'd be hard-pressed to find any non-comic book fan who would care about Iron Man. And so, I mean, that's another example of sort of an actor putting his distinctiveness and his specificity on a character. So, I mean, but in the case of Spider-Man and Batman, they've sort of become interchangeable.
Yeah. And those, I mean, Robert Downey Jr. kind of embodied Iron Man like way back when. I feel like back when these kind of things, this movement was like starting, you know, with these big Marvel movies. And now I feel like maybe they're overthinking it, or maybe they've gotten ahead of themselves. But it's like, did Ben Affleck really get a chance to be Batman?
That's a good
point. Like, I don't think he did. Batman versus Superman, it's like he was fighting these guys with machine guns and like was that the one with Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor?
Yes,
I think it was. So it's like, and then, you know, even him and Henry Cavill didn't really get to like fight all that much towards the end. It was just a bad like version of Batman. And it's like, maybe if he had been the kind of Batman skulking around in the shadows, you know, fighting bank robbers or whatever, it would have given people a little bit of a better depth that Ben Affleck can do.
I think the movie, I don't think the movie served him well. I thought he did make a good Batman. I thought what we saw of him as Batman in the movies, it's hard to say because in all these movies, he was a co-star. None of these Batman movies were Batman movies.
So he was Batman for Batman versus Superman, Suicide Squad, and what else? Justice League. Okay, yeah. So then they wanted to do a standalone Batman, is that correct?
Yes.
That's coming out in 2021?
Yes.
Okay.
Directed by Matt Reeves.
Matt Reeves, who did what?
The Planet of the Apes, the last two Planet of the Apes movies.
Oh, okay.
And Cloverfield.
So what have you heard about who's going to potentially replace Ben Affleck?
Well, I saw this list, and I thought I'd share it. Armie Hammer, who interestingly was once going to play Batman in George Miller's Justice League movie. That was about 15 years ago. Richard Madden of Game of Thrones and The Bodyguard fame. Charlie Cox of Netflix's Daredevil fame. Oscar Isaac, I guess, you know, we just kind of attach Oscar Isaac to everything at this point.
Yeah, why not?
Same with Michael B. Jordan, for that matter.
Yeah.
Which, bold choice. I mean, a black Batman would be a bold choice.
That would, yeah.
And Aaron Taylor Johnson, who's played a couple of superheroes.
From Nocturnal Animals fame.
Yes. Well, I was going to also say Kick-Ass and Avengers Age of Ultron to keep it in the superhero.
Right, yeah.
No. Yeah.
So you can actually have the authority on that stuff.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, he knows what it's like to have to work out to play a superhero.
I don't know, man. Like, I don't really have any attachment to that character. Like, I could really care less. But Armie Hammer just seems too boyish and innocent. You know what I mean?
Really?
I feel like Ben Affleck was okay because he could pull off the kind of brooding, you know, tough guy, but also the kind of sensitive or intellectual rather, detective that Batman is.
It's disappointing because I think the building blocks were there, and I think in to sort of put a pin in this, I don't think the problem with any of the DC movies so far has been casting.
No, that's
I think they've all been very well cast.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the stories they've been telling and the way they've been telling them, but we'll see what happens.
So this one coming in 2021, The Batman. That going to be another reboot? Bruce Wayne's parents die for like the 20th time and whatnot.
Gotta see those parents die, man.
Yeah.
We don't know if how he becomes Batman if we don't see them die. Anyway.
There's a checklist when you do a Batman movie now. But wasn't everyone like complaining about Heath Ledger as the Joker back in 2008? Like, wasn't everyone like
when
furious
he was first
about
cast
that?
As yeah. the Joker? Oh, yeah. Yeah, everybody hates every comic book movie casting
yeah,
decision
that's
until
what I'm
they
saying,
see it.
Man. Like, but, just, yeah. Except Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor. That was just like really bad, I felt.
It wasn't great. Of course, they have. Never mind. I'm not going to get into it. So Netflix.
I'm not still bitter from meeting Jesse Eisenberg at the Starbucks in Toronto.
We'll have to hear that story sometime.
All right.
But Netflix, getting back to Netflix, Catherine Tate, the president of the CBC, mm-hmm. Was at an event on Canadian media, the Canadian Media Producers Association, and she basically compared Netflix to British and French colonialism in the 17th and 18th centuries. Basically that Netflix is dominating the world. Netflix actually has footprints in every country, and except for China now, it's a global power. But what I find particularly interesting is that if you go to Netflix, you'll probably find more Canadian content than any other Canadian streaming service. So it seems like kind of a poor target to pick on.
I actually forget her quotes. Like, did she elaborate on why, or is it just because they're getting big?
Well, it's because Netflix is basically – the way she compared it is to that Netflix is basically like the viceroy was in India, whereas it's a power that comes in, establishes itself over the local community – and insists that everybody play by their rules. Because part of the Netflix problem is that media producers are having it with Netflix. It doesn't pay into the Canadian Media Production Fund, which is one of those tax incentive programs that helps fund Canadian movies and TV. You don't pay HST or GST with your Netflix subscription. Mm-hmm. So it feels like it can come in, dominate, and there's kind of no benefit to the Canadian media side. Even though I would point out one of the benefits to the Canadian media side is taking Canadian shows, like CBC shows.
Well, that's the thing.
Like Schitt's Creek and putting it on Netflix. And like Schitt's Creek is a huge hit. Not a huge hit, but it's a definite hit in the United States because it's available on Netflix in the United States.
Well, the only reason I saw Kim's Convenience was because it came on Netflix Canada as well.
Right.
So is her criticism leveled more at the harm it's doing to Canadian like entertainment industry, or just that it's general kind of consuming everything? The way that she's describing Netflix, I have to say, sounds exactly like Disney. Like, isn't Disney the one that's actually like doing the
absorbing
colonialism?
It. Yeah.
It's like Netflix is getting big, absolutely. But Disney's doing exactly what she is talking about. It's
right.
Like you even saw it with Tarantino as well. They were like, if you don't show whatever it was, The Last Jedi at your theater,
right,
then they threatened him in some way. It's like
right.
You can't show The Hateful Eight or something without showing our movie. They threatened him in some way. So for me, it's like Disney is the one that's
right.
The real like issue. I don't know about Netflix.
But of course, it's like somewhat contained to the United States, where Disney isn't absorbing like Entertainment One, which is a Canadian company, or it isn't absorbing like CTV or something like that. It's absorbing other American media outlets. I think Catherine Tate's point was that Netflix will move into an area, say, these are our rules. You either play by them or you don't play with us. And because Netflix is a brand name in almost virtually the same way you can think of Kleenex as a brand name, mm-hmm. or Xerox as a brand name.
Not necessarily like the name of the product, but
right.
The brand. Yeah.
Right. So that you have this big industry that is U.S.-based coming in and saying, you know what, we're not going to play by the rules you've established. You're going to play by the rules we've established. And I think that's her point about the colonialism. Having said that, though, I think Canadian media players have a very poor history of understanding how the media landscape has changed. Because I remember Marianne Turkey of the president of CTV going on a tangent about how she was mad at her daughter, her teenage daughter, for using a VPN to access Netflix in the States, because instead of using Netflix Canada or watching CTV, I guess. And what struck me about that was how tenured it was, because it was around the time, or shortly after the time, Bell launched Crave. And it's like, well, yeah, if you put something people want to see on your streaming service, then maybe people will use that streaming service. Until recently, Crave has been very kind of cumbersome and not really like viewer, like not really meant to appeal to necessarily people who just want to stream. It's been treated very much like an add-on service, like any additional Bell service.
Yeah. And so is it possible there's some bitterness or jealousy coming, sure, from these CBC people? Like,
yeah,
they can feel streaming kind of taking over their bread and butter, which is television.
Right. But then also you have CBC having its own streaming site called Gem. But if you watch the commercials for Gem, you have absolutely...
Is that out right now?
Yeah.
CBC has its own streaming site?
Called Gem.
Okay, and it streams what, all Canadian
shows? Like Canadian shows, yeah.
Okay.
And I think there's some imports as well. But I mean, it's really hard to nail down what this is if you just watch the TV commercials, because it's just these commercials with clips from Kim's Convenience and 22 Minutes and Schitt's Creek and
Mr.
Burden
D.
of Truth and Mr. D, and just like, it's like, oh, okay, so CBC Gem, okay, moving on. But yeah, it strikes me as peculiar, because these media companies don't, the Canadian ones are, I think, are talking in one language. And
yeah not necessarily just in terms of streaming services, but you know, all of my professors when I was at film school were working in the industry, and they talk about, you know, some of the counterintuitive things that mm-hmm. seem to be going on in our industry.
Yeah. We'll wrap up by just talking about another new streaming service. It's actually new to Canada as well to the United States. I think we talked last fall when Filmstruck was canceled. Not you and me, Vince, but I think on the show we talked about
it.
Filmstruck was a streaming service in the States that had a lot of old movies on it, including the Criterion Collection, which is this collection of movies that are chosen for preservation and documentation.
And Armageddon for some reason.
I have the Armageddon Criterion.
Oh.
Because it exists.
Did they ever explain why Armageddon is on Criterion?
I think it's in the liner notes. I should bring them in sometime.
Yeah.
But okay. I have it because it exists, and that's the only reason I have it. But so there's going to be a Criterion channel starting on April the 8th. It is going to be $9.99 a month or $89.99 a year. And at the same time, we're losing Ultraviolet, which you may recognize if... from your Blu-ray. You open the Blu-ray, it has this purple slip that says Ultraviolet, download your Ultraviolet.
Yes. So that...
that's going away.
So there will no longer be that purple slip when I buy a Blu-ray?
No.
Oh, okay. Like, so Ultraviolet is also a streaming service where... Is that correct?
Well, it's like a cloud.
Right, okay.
So it's a cloud accounting... it's like a cloud library of movies. You punch in your code, you get access to the movie that... You've got access.
So why
to.
Do I care that they're closing down that and then getting the Criterion channel, which to me sounds slightly superior?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, it's been this thing that if you buy DVDs and Blu-rays, it's sort of in there. And I think I once tried to get an Ultraviolet account, but you had to get an account on something else. And I was like, I don't want any part of, like, upselling me on things.
Yeah.
And so I just didn't bother. So in my
they're trying to cross the universes, though.
They're trying to cross the streams. But yeah, no, it's just it's crazy to that, you know, it just makes you think, like, how, I guess, short, like, sometimes that these nebulous it is.
Yeah.
You know, because there's now some question about what happens to all your Ultraviolet movies.
I don't know.
Well, we'll say goodbye to Ultraviolet with a little tribute called Purple Rain.
Oh, that's wonderful, yeah.
It's Black History Month, and the Ultraviolet slips were purple.
Let's, yeah.
So why not?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. We'll be right back with our review of Velvet Buzzsaw. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Bearded downtown poser. He hasn't had, like, an original idea in his whole life. On top of which, he steals from everyone. But you know that, right?
I'm very familiar with his work.
You should go to his show. See for yourself how much he sucks. Then do what you do.
Are you serious?
For me.
And that was a clip from Velvet Buzzsaw. It is a new film from Dan Gilroy. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Renee Russo, Zaw Ashton, Tom Sturridge, Tony Collette, Natalia Dyer, and the one and only John Malkovich.
Reminds me of Lollipop Chainsaw, this video game. Came out many years ago. I don't know why. Every time I hear that title, Velvet Buzzsaw, I think of Lollipop Chainsaw.
It is an unusual title.
And it's never really, like, explained either. I mean, it's explained, but it never really has any significance. It
doesn't really have any bearing on the plot.
I was like, wait until the very end. I was like, oh, they're going to explain this.
And Vince was like, what does it mean?
No.
Yeah, so it's on Netflix now. The director, Dan Gilroy, not his last film, because he also did Roman Israel Esquire. But then the one that that kind of broke through for him was Nightcrawler, which also starred Jake Gyllenhaal and Renee Russo. Also took place in L.A., also about some rather unsavory characters doing unsavory things.
Well, that's the thing. This just... when somebody's made this few films, you can't really determine what kind of filmmaker they are. But now you can kind of get a sense of what kind of stories he likes to play around with.
Mm-hmm.
Nightcrawler, I remember leaving the theater thinking that was a masterpiece. I was like, this man is going to get an Oscar
nomination for
writing this movie. And he ended up doing that. But you're right. It's like this unsavory character who is kind of stepping over all of these people to get to the very top. And Roman J. Israel Esquire was kind of the same thing. You know, Denzel Washington was this kind of idealistic lawyer. And then his kind of character arc throughout the film is getting more and more sleazy as Colin Farrell kind of like pulls him in. So he obviously likes those kinds of narratives, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But man, this was a weird movie. This was like unlike anything he had done before. And I really don't know how I feel about this movie. It is so weird.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, actually. I think there's an interesting comparison that could be made between Nightcrawler and Velvet Buzzsaw and Nicholas Winding Refn. Thank you. I got the two. But between his film Driver and then he did Only God Forgives, but then after that he did Neon Demon, which is also like Driver's about sort of the seedy underbelly of LA, a lot of night shoots. Neon Demon is kind of similar in terms of like the art world and like modeling and sort of the inherent evils of it, and cannibalizing people was a part of that movie too. So there's an interesting, I think, there's an interesting think piece here where we can write about those four movies together as a package and what it says about the filmmakers to in terms of tackling the very dark essences of LA life.
Well, they were also very straightforward movies too. Drive is like this robbery gone wrong, and then it's really about the fallout from the robbery gone wrong. Mm-hmm. Nightcrawler is really like, you know, what he's doing early in the film is kind of what he ends up doing just on a larger scale throughout the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. So they're both kind of very tight. Very
tight.
About, you know, young men who are kind of obsessed with something.
Yeah.
But this one is... So Jake Gyllenhaal plays this incredibly obnoxious, like, art critic.
That's an oxymoron.
First of all, it just drops you into, like, these art meetings and this art world, and there are so many characters, and it never really stops to, like, establish who any of these people are.
I like that, though.
Which is really?
Yeah.
I don't know, because Nightcrawler did it so beautifully. It's like he's, you know, it starts, this guy's trying to cut open this fence. The security guard's like, what are you doing? And he sees this watch on the security guard's wrist, and then it cuts to him after they've fought wearing the security guard's wrist. And it's like, yeah, that's a beautiful opening. That's a beautiful way to establish someone's character, you know what I mean? And then he tries to go and sell the scrap metal to the guy. You're like, yeah, I get a sense of who this character is, but all
Nightcrawler did it better. But I did like
Velvet Buzzsaw are so obnoxious, and maybe that's what he was like going for. Because eventually, it does kind of turn into this weird horror slasher movie where all of these mean and egregiously like self-centered people kind of get what's coming to them.
Yes,
so it's like I can get that, but. The horror stuff seems almost like an afterthought. It's like, and I think there was a really good, interesting like B movie there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The idea of like an artist, this painter who had passed away, and he's kind of haunting the people who are exploiting his work for like commercial gain.
Right.
That's like a really nice like B movie kind of horror, and it's like, why did you drag it down with like an hour of this like OC love triangle that had nothing to do with what the movie is ultimately going to be about, which is like, you know, people kind of being haunted by this artist who has passed away.
Right.
And I was so frustrated, man. I was like, you, if you had just done what happens like 40 minutes into the movie, at the very beginning of the movie, you had established that this was going to be kind of a schlocky kind of horror movie, then I would have been right there with you. But instead, you bogged it down for the first like 40 minutes with this bizarre story. And then John Malkovich has like really nothing to do with anything. And it's like, here he is again, kind of playing this cynical, like sour-faced guy that he played in Bird Box as well. It's like, what are you doing, man? And
you know what? I enjoyed it. Like when the camera, I don't know how intentional this was, but every time sort of John Malkovich comes out, the camera feels like it just like, oh, here's John Malkovich. And it kind of goes with him. It's sort of like this eager presence, like we're in the presence of John Malkovich. Here's John Malkovich.
Yeah.
And although I agree, he's not used to particularly great effect. So maybe that's the point. I don't know. I don't know, because I find like...
Is he becoming like a... I don't know. There are so many examples of this. Is he becoming a Kevin Costner? He just like shows up, does the gig, and then goes
maybe.
Home.
I mean,
I don't know.
Kevin, you know, John Malkovich has got to eat. But it's... I find that there's also an artist character, another artist character, and it feels like those characters specifically are de-emphasized. Even though it's a movie about the art world, we don't really get into the artist too terribly much. And even the
like at all.
Like, yeah.
She like literally, yeah, sorry.
Even the character whose art this comes from, Deese, we only ever see Deese as a dead body.
Yeah.
And there's not much... I think in a more straightforward horror movie, there'd be a Scooby gang who would be trying to dig through the history of this Deese guy and trying to find out what happened to him and what happened to his family and how his art is doing all these weird things. And I think it speaks to the self-centeredness of the people that no one in this movie, even the person, Morph, who's writing the Jake Gyllenhaal character, who's supposedly writing a book about Deese, seems terribly uninterested in actually getting to the bottom of who Deese was.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. And what it needed was that it needed Deese to, like, be alive for a little bit to explain, like, why or what his perspective was.
Right.
Because the whole thing is, like, she, the main character, the woman that we kind of, the protagonist that we kind of follow.
Dominica.
She's
not good. She's the worst part of it.
There's a lot of, like, not good in this. There's her, and then there's this, like, South African, like, hotshot art buyer.
Right.
I've never seen this guy before in any movie or show, but I really didn't like him.
Yeah. That's the
and then
the
there's
Tom,
like,
Strutbridge character.
Yeah, and then there's the up-and-coming, like, artist that I just didn't buy at all. But anyway, so she's living in the same building, the same apartment building as this Deese guy. Then one day discovers that he's, like, dead in the building, goes into his abandoned apartment building, discovers that he is actually, like, a master painter and starts kind of stealing all of his stuff.
Right.
And,
well, she finds out it was his express wishes that all his art be destroyed.
Right. So what it needed was a crucial scene where Deese is like, no, this is my art. I believe art is done for my my own kind of personal purposes. And the last thing that I would ever want is for somebody to sell my art to some big wig or whatever. But instead, it's like, yeah, we get this because what results from that is, like, they all kind of get haunted, like a horror movie.
Yeah.
But it's like you never established that he was, like, against this. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, all you over.
If he had said,
yeah,
don't do this,
yeah,
and then died and then they did it, I could understand why he was haunting them. But it really wasn't. And then they just bog it down with, like, yeah, these absurd love triangles between Jake Gyllenhaal. And Jake Gyllenhaal is gay, and he's got this boyfriend, but he's also in love with the female protagonist.
Yeah.
And you never really know what Dan Gilroy is, like, trying to, like, what are you doing? Like, are you, is this kind of a satirical takedown of the modern art world?
Right.
Or is this kind of just a schlocky horror movie that's set in the art world? It's never really, like, established.
Well,
so.
I was reading an article where apparently he was inspired because of his experience with Superman Lives, which way back in 20 years ago, they were working on a live-action version of The Death of Superman with Tim Burton, and it was called Superman Lives. And Dan Gilroy was one of, like, 25 screenwriters who was on that project. And he was, I guess he was one of the last ones when the project was canceled, basically 2 weeks before it was supposed to begin shooting. And so he was felt, I guess, a bit of you know, remorse having worked so long on this project and then just have it cancel and fall underneath him. Because there's actually reams of work, and there's actually a whole documentary about the work on Superman Lives. It's called, I don't know when, it was John Schnepp who made it. He unfortunately passed away last year, but it should be easy enough to find. It's like Who Killed the Life and Death of Superman Lives or something. Mm-hmm. What happened?
And wasn't Kevin Smith attached to it somehow? Or
Kevin
was
Smith was
else?
The very first screenwriter who was brought in to adapt
right.
The Death of Superman, and then they hired Tim Burton, and Tim Burton fired Burton fired Kevin Smith.
He just didn't like his version, or
I don't think a more straightforward adaptation of The Death of Superman was Tim Burton's cup of tea.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that started the Tim Burton Kevin Smith feud.
Okay.
The famous Tim Burton Kevin Smith feud.
Right. And you know, there was a Netflix documentary about this Polish artist Zukalski.
Yes.
All of his work was pretty much destroyed in World War II when the Nazis bombed this art gallery where all of his stuff had been housed. So there's some interesting themes about, you know, what you're talking about, working a lot on these things only to see them kind of get denigrated.
That art can be intrinsic, and, you know, you could you know, through no fault of your own, just have it all taken away. And I guess that maybe that's at the heart of this. One of the things I did find interesting was actually near the end where Dominica calls the Rene Russo character, who's her boss at this art gallery. And after, like, the dead bodies have piled up and people have been killed and they sort of fully understand the consequences of their action. And Dominica says to Rene Russo, like, knowing what we know now, would that change anything? Mm-hmm. And Rene Russo just says, no.
Yeah.
There's a sort of bizarre thing that, you know, experience does not necessarily make you any the wiser if you're just sort of like basic within your intent. And the base intent of this all along was just to make money off this poor man who was, when you see the artwork, and I think the artwork,
it actually is like
really
beautiful.
Interesting. Yeah.
They clearly got somebody talented to like
yes,
work.
Yes. The artwork is tremendous. But that, you know, this poor man who, you know, it's heavily implied that he's been through some stuff, mm-hmm. and maybe was a bit of a monster himself, but, you know, there was clearly suffering in his life. But they are none the wiser sort of learning from not only his suffering, but from learning from their own suffering, mm-hmm. all their friends dead. I think there's some kind of commentary there. I'm not sure if it sells, like you said.
And with that being said, the movie does get fun, like, at a certain point.
Oh, yes.
Like, when you start to realize what's going to happen, like, these people who have kind of exploited his work are all going to, like, be killed. And I don't think that's, like, by him in some way, in a kind of Final Destination-esque kind of way. His
right.
actual, like, body isn't going to appear, but he does cause their deaths via, you know, kind of spiritual means. But
it's funny. I did see someone say that this was, like, Steven Soderbergh's Final Destination.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know whether to laugh or cry at that. Maybe if I tweet him,
I'm laughing already.
He'll finally get back to me. But
if you poke him enough.
Yeah, and there's like okay, there's like a slasher formula happening
yes.
for a little bit. It's like one after another, and you're like, yeah, this is interesting, but it's way too late in the film. At
yeah.
that point, it's like you're already an hour into it, and it was like, why did you spend so much time at the beginning setting up all these characters if
right.
you were just going to kill them like that?
Yeah, and Toni Collette's character is like a museum curator, but now she's like gotten a job where she's like.
There are too many characters, man. Like,
yeah.
just yeah.
But there's definitely two brains at work here. One of them is like the slasher film. The other is like the takedown piece of you know modern art.
You got to wonder if he added in the slasher stuff just to make it a little bit more marketable, to make it like
it could.
We got to have something for the average kind of layperson.
Because there's the one kill in particular where a character puts her arm into that. Sculpture that
yeah.
is the sphere and has the holes in it. That is probably like that. That's like an 80s slasher movie
yeah.
level kill, just with the bloody stump and everything.
It just, how could it not remind you of Phantasm?
Yeah,
like, in some way.
Yeah, or you know, any of them really, like Phantasm, like Nightmare on Elm Street,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
It's just like all these kills are sort of like garish in their you know over the topness. And part of it, too, is I'm not sure about the, not to get really into the weeds, but like the cinematography, it really seemed like it was shot in the 90s. And I'm not sure if that was intentional or not, or if it was just like an effect of watching it on TV, on Netflix. But there's just something very flat about it, which might have worked for the movie.
Yeah.
But it's not, I did not find it terribly cinematic.
Right. I can't comment on the cinematography, I have to say. I just don't know.
There's just, but just for me, there was something about it that seemed very, very flat, that it did, like, it didn't really jump off the screen. And
yeah.
it really should have, you know, if you wanted to lean a bit more into, like, some of the visual effects were very well done,
mm-hmm.
I thought. There's, like, a lot of, like, these sort of blink and you'll miss it things. That are very effective. But of course, that's like getting later into the movie, as you said, after we've dealt with everybody's neuroses
yeah.
and issues. But the film doesn't sort of jump. You know, Nightcrawler had was really what looked like a really good movie. A lot of it, again, takes place at night, but it still like sort of jumps off the screen. There's nothing flat about it.
Yeah,
this feels very, very flat. Just looking at it, it looks flat.
Yeah, and which is bizarre because it's by one of the great cinematographers working today, Robert Elswit, mm-hmm. who of course won an Oscar for There Will Be Blood. Mm-hmm. So it's weird that he, and I think he shot Nightcrawler as well.
He might have.
Weird that it's so flat, but there were a couple times where he was like trying to like be bold in a way. It was like we would follow somebody through the art gallery, and then like somebody else would be coming a different direction, and then we would like follow them.
Yeah,
and it's like, okay, Dan Gilroy's clearly trying to do like a one take.
It's tracking shot. Yeah, and it's some of it's ambitious to be sure. It's not, I don't think it's got its stuff together mm-hmm. in quite the same way Nightcrawler had. I think, I don't know if whether it was in the writing, whether it's in the production or what it is, or just the idea wasn't refined enough. I think there was a really great idea here, and I think I did like this.
And it sounds like Jake Gyllenhaal is kind of convincing, like the way that yes. he speaks about art. It's like he kind of sounds like J.K. Simmons in Whiplash. It's like they're using lingo that seems authentic.
That's an interesting comparison, too, because what I liked about the Jake Gyllenhaal character, in terms of way critics are typically portrayed in movies, either critics are incredibly sort of like just dickish and mean, and it's usually some kind of statement on the part of the filmmaker that, mm-hmm. you know... My last movie was lambasted by critics, so now I'm going to put Mayor Ebert in this one.
Yeah. Who would ever do that?
No or it's like someone like Bob Balaban in The Lady in the Water, where they're incredibly erudite and, you know, offish. And
yeah.
They're just like so far up their own rears, it's impossible to get
Even
something
Birdman,
human out of them.
One of my favorite movies is guilty of doing that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I appreciate – and there's one line – where Jake Gyllenhaal says, where somebody was complaining, I think it was at the funeral scene where he's like criticizing the organ music and the color yeah. of the casket, and somebody says to him like why are you just so critical all the time? It's like you can't turn it off. And he's like, well, it's my job. I'm selective.
Yeah. And it's like things like that kind of reveal his character. Yeah. But it's like at that point, it's like somebody was just murdered like gruesomely kind of thing. It's like, would he really be? But the other thing about Nightcrawler, too, is that it, like all of its characters kind of paid off in some way, right?
Yes.
You had this kind of weird Bill, was it Bill Pullman or was it Bill Paxton? Bill Paxton, character.
Yeah.
And he kind of comes in like every once in a while just to like announce his presence. And you're like, I don't really know where this is going. And yeah. then you realize he uses the Bill Paxton character or he kind of... manipulates the Bill Paxton character to his own kind of gain, which is what he does with his partner eventually too.
Mm-hmm.
But they all kind of, there's a purpose for right. all of them
yeah.
that kind of build somewhere. And I just don't feel like there's this, this kind of nebbish, like,
Coco
employee.
Yeah.
yeah. And she just kind of is there for some weird, like, comic relief, but it's yeah. not very funny because she just is the one that's stumbling on
that
these
finds
dead
all the
bodies.
Dead bodies. Yeah,
and then it's like
it never pays
she's
off.
She's like the next scene. She's like, "Oh, I need a job," and it's like, "Really? You just saw somebody like gruesomely murdered, and now that's what's on your mind?" Okay,
and not for nothing, but in an incredibly small world like the art world, it would get around that you're kind of like yeah. the one who's finding all the bodies, and I think it'd be really hard for you to find work when you, after the first couple of dead bodies you find.
Yeah.
But we'll have to leave that there.
So ultimately, if my opinion is going to make or break anybody's determination to watch this movie, I would have to pass on this, honestly. Like, it's just the bad far outweigh the good, I think.
Well, I think I enjoyed it a bit more than you.
Okay. All right.
And we'll wrap up the show there. And if you like this episode of End Credits, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. We're on the social medias at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And just a public service announcement, we will not be on next week because CFRU will be running Black History Month programming from Monday through Thursday, 12 to 6 next week. So we will be back the next week with another new episode. And Vince, if people want to vehemently disagree with you on anything Soderbergh related, or maybe Steven Soderbergh wants to reach out to you, where can he find you?
Well, Steven Soderbergh has had many chances to reach out to me, Mr. Soderbergh. Just like to point that out. You can reach me on Twitter at vmassin5.
And you can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my website, guelphpolitico.ca. I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And until then, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back the week after next for more End Credits, and we will see you then.